So I did want to go over the answers to the exam today so that you have a chance to review it, to be able to ask questions tomorrow, since tomorrow is our last full day of class. Now, for this exam, there may very likely be a curve in addition to the curve that's already stated in the green sheet, in that if you do higher on your final exam that you than you do on any of your other regular exams in terms of percentage, you get to replace that lowest exam with your final. However, the average for this test was a little bit lower than historically what I've seen in the past, and so after I see those final grades, I may end up making an adjustment, because as a class average, the average did end up being a 96, which corresponds to something like a 62%. So if you do have concerns about how the exam was graded, I do have a detailed grading chart, and you're welcome to follow me after class to office hours. But let's go ahead and go over the answers to the exam. So question one, we had four different mechanisms, and you were supposed to write out the mechanism. You were also given some products, and you were supposed to decide which of those products was going to be the major product form, and you were supposed to use your mechanism to justify which of those major products formed. So first reaction was of an alkene with tosic acid and water. So by far the most common mistake for this problem was treating the tosic acid as if it was the molecule that was going to add in as the electrophile. So remember that tosic acid we had used in the past as a strong acid catalyst. It's exactly that compound that I had said was a organic soluble solid. It's very easily manipulable. It's very inexpensive. It's a strong acid, and the conjugate that you get from that acid is not at all nucleophilic. So the only reaction that's going to occur here with the alkene is that the alkene is going to attack the H plus of that acid. The tosylate that's then formed as a byproduct does not participate in the reaction because it's not a nucleophile. Instead, it is the water that's around that's going to end up being the nucleophile. And so this is simple electrophilic addition using water. So first step in the mechanism would be for the double bond to attack H+. If you didn't show it attacking H+, if you did instead have it attacking the tosic acid, and you could have, in fact, abbreviated tosic acid, you need to show the attack on the hydrogen, and then you need to show that hydrogen dissociating from tosic acid, since unless it's a borane-type compound, you can't have more than one bond to hydrogen at a time. So if I abbreviate using OTS for tosylate, then the first step of the reaction would look like this. Now, by far, the most likely intermediate is going to be the carbocation that I've shown here, which, in fact, is the reason that the product that we end up with is going to be an alcohol, where the alcohol is at this most substituted position. This is Markovnikov addition, and that carbocation is the most stabilized by hyperconjugation. So it is extraordinarily unlikely in this case that you're going to form the secondary carbocation. That's exactly what the point of Markovnikov addition is. So this is going to be the likely intermediate, which now will be attacked by water. Since it is a planar intermediate, then you can have attack from both faces of that carbocation, so you are going to end up with an enantiomeric mixture. Now, as I had said in the directions, you were allowed to show just the formation of one of the products to reduce how much time it took to write down the answer, as long as you then said something about there being enantiomers in your product mixture. So I will do exactly that, show one of the possible products. After water does attack, you're going to end up with an oxonium ion that'll deprotonate. And we end up with the alcohol plus its enantiomer. So the first of the two products listed was the most likely of the products. And again, this is simple electrophilic addition. So any questions on that problem? Yes?
For the final, should we expect any reagent above the arrow? Because when I first saw that, because I went over the review step that mm-hmm. was on Friday, and I'm thinking, wow, that looks like a tosylate of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But it should we anticipate any potential acid catalysts, even those that are a little bit more scary looking like that?
Well, actually, it's probably going to be this compound I would use as an acid catalyst, because it really is such the frequent compound used. Other questions? All right, the second mechanism. Here we had a tosylate. A tosylate that was at a tertiary carbon. I'm sorry, not tosylate, mesylate. And reacted with sodium hydroxide and heat. So this is an elimination reaction because we have a strong base with heat with a good leaving group that's on a tertiary position. Since we have a strong base, what form of elimination is this going to be? E2, bimolecular elimination, which means that the base is involved at the same time that the leaving group leaves. So it would be incorrect to show the leaving group coming off as its own individual step and then showing the hydrogen removed afterwards. You have to show the removal of that hydrogen and the leaving of the leaving group at the same time. This is elimination reaction, so if you showed the nucleophile coming in to attack the leaving group directly, that would be more like a substitution reaction. So in fact, that was the most common mistake, to show hydroxide attacking the tosylate. But in elimination, it's not the tosylate that's going to be attacked, it's one of the hydrogens next door. And in fact, the most likely one in this case to be attacked is the hydrogen that is at the other tertiary center. Why? Because once we eliminate that hydrogen, we're going to form the alkene that has the most substituents on it. And as we've discussed, the more substituents that we have on an alkene, the more hyperconjugation that we have to stabilize that alkene. Now, we had talked about the possibility of causing exactly that opposite behavior by causing a kinetic effect. But that would be using a bulky base like potassium T-butoxide. Since we just have the small base of sodium hydroxide, we're going to get regular thermodynamic elimination. So hydroxide attacks the hydrogen. The pair of electrons that had been in that bond collapses towards the leaving group. The leaving group leaves. And we end up with the first of the products listed. That one, again, would be the most likely product. And again, this one has the most substitution. Questions about that problem? Yes? It is a tertiary substrate because the carbon that the top of mesylate is attached to has three other carbons on it. And then the neighbor where the hydrogen is located, since there's three other carbons attached to that position, it's also a tertiary. Other questions? Yes?
Why do we need heat for this reaction?
You probably don't to get it to work at all, but heat would increase the rate of reaction. Yes?
So if the nucleophile was bulky, that's how could be the primary.
Right. So the question was if we did use that bulky T-butoxide as an ion instead, well, then it would be from the primary position here that the elimination would most likely occur from, and that would be the kinetic product. Yes?
Could you do the entire mechanism to get to the third product? Because we only have to show how to get to one of them, but the third one, is there a methyl shift of some kind?
Let's see. For that third one, it would be like this.
It just looks like the trans version of the second one, so I'm wondering if it's just the cis and trans situation or if there's any other...
It is just the cis and trans of the second one.
So that's all it is?
That's all it is. Did you still want me to write it out then?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So let me make sure I'm circling the right hydrogen here. It would be this one. So you would get the, as you said, the cis-looking versus the trans-looking products. The single bond is rotatable until elimination occurs. All right, the next mechanism. Here we start with a plain alkane, react it with chlorine and light to produce a series of monohalogenated products. And it does turn out that the four different products shown are four valid products. Now let's see which one is going to be the most likely of the products, though, and let's review the mechanism of the reaction. This was probably the mechanism that had the most problems with it, because it was the one radical mechanism that we had covered during the quarter. Remember that this mechanism had three distinct components to it. Initiation, where the chlorine itself gets dissociated by the light. Then the chlorine radical ends up in a two-step process, adding to the alkane, that's the propagation step, and then there's a termination step that follows it. Since this is a radical process, none of the arrows that you use should be the double-headed arrow that we've used almost everywhere else. They should all be single-headed arrows. So first step, is the dissociation of chlorine-chlorine bond. After the formation of that chlorine radical, you're going to have a dissociation, an abstraction of a hydrogen. And notice that there are three arrows in that part of the mechanism, because the chloride is going to attack the hydrogen, the hydrogen bond's going to break, but since this is a single electron process, that one bond has two electrons, so you have to have two arrows coming from that one bond. There is also the electron coming from chlorine itself. So two of those arrows, one from the bond, one from chlorine, meet, and that ends up being the abstraction of hydrogen. And then the third arrow, that's falling back towards the alkane itself, and so that's how you end up with the alkyl radical. So that's the first of the two steps of the propagation. Afterwards, the radical turns around and attacks another full molecule of chlorine. Now, yes, you could have an attack on a chloride radical, but that's not the propagation step, that's a termination step. So the next step, really, the one that happens more commonly, again involves three arrows. There's the scission of that chlorine-chlorine bond, and then the attack of the radical on one of those chlorines. That will give us one of the products. It'll regenerate the chlorine radical. And then the directions did indicate you only need to show one of the ending steps, so one of the forms of termination. And the simplest one, then, could just be for two chloride radicals to recombine. Now, this is, in fact, the most likely of the products. Because although the tertiary center is more reactive, it does form the more substituted radical. The difference in reactivity between a primary, secondary, and tertiary position is only 1 to 4 to 5. Since we only have one tertiary hydrogen, but we have two secondary hydrogens, the reactivity multiplied by the number of hydrogens means that this is going to be the more populous of the products. In fact, this is exactly the example that we had done in lecture. So if you go back and look at the tertiary, would have had a relative population of 5. The secondary has a relative population of 8. From the one side where there's a primary, that would have a relative population of 3. That would be the relative reactivity of 1 times the 3 hydrogens present. And then on the other side here, the two methyl groups are chemically equivalent. So that would be 6 in terms of the number of hydrogens times 1 for the reactivity. So again, less populous than this product. Yes.
I didn't quite understand that when you explained that in lecture.
Okay.
Because my understanding is that most compounds, wherever the site of attachment is usually the site that will produce the most stable product. So in this case, why is this a radical reaction? Why would the chlorine choose
necessarily to radical reactions, but it's one of the major features of this particular reaction. It's because statistically, as that fluorine tries to react with a molecule, it's got all these different hydrogens it can react with. So if subtracting out that difference in reactivity, if you just think statistically, what's the likelihood it's going to attack in a certain position, it depends on how many hydrogens are attached to that position. So you take that relative number of hydrogens, then multiply it by its relative reactivity, and combined, that tells you what kind of product is more likely to form.
But it's not like an empirical value of the statistics that you're referring to, right?
It's how many hydrogens are there, period.
So there's three on that end.
Mm-hmm. So it would be, if you ignored reactivity, it'd be twice as likely to attack here, three times as likely here, six times as likely there, if they had exactly the same reactivity.
Okay.
They don't have the same reactivity, so multiply by that reactivity, and that's how you get the proportion of which product will form.
Where do you get this reactivity to know where to place the chlorine?
The numbers, as far as the relative reactivity, that's what we had covered in lecture. For chlorine, the relative reactivity is 1 versus 4 versus 5, and for bromine, it was 1 versus 80 versus 1600. Yes?
Does it really matter where you put the hydrogen?
Does it matter where you put the hydrogen? As far as how you drew the mechanism?
Yeah, you know, the first where you got the hydrogen.
You just need to show the hydrogen, and you need to show one of the bonds for that hydrogen going back to the radical, and the other one reacting with the chlorine. Sure, that's a valid product, and that would be okay for the mechanism as long as you came back and circled this one as your most likely product. Other questions on this reaction? All right, then let's go to the last of the mechanisms. This was cyclohexene. Reacting with bromine. Now the key difference between this reaction and the one we saw previously is that light is not involved in this reaction. And unless light is specified, you cannot say that light is there. Since you just have plain bromine, that means you're going to have an electrophilic addition, and specifically this is going to be for the formation of a vicinal dihalide. So the first step of the reaction is attack on bromine. We're back to using regular double-headed arrows because this is an ionic or an electron pair mechanism. And because we against have a planar species that's getting attacked, we have the possibility of forming enantiomers. So again, for showing your answer, you only need to show it for one product, which is again what I'm going to do here. This is that cyclobromonium ion that we had discussed in class. And this is actually the key part of the mechanism that explains what is the most likely product. Because you had two products that were shown, one where you had the bromine cis to each other on the ring, one where the product was trans. Well, only the trans one is going to form, because the ring does not open until it is attacked by the incoming bromine. So the attack only occurs from the opposite side, which means you're only going to get inversion of configuration. Again, though, you'll also get its enantiomer. So because of that cyclic intermediate, that's why the stereochemistry of the reaction is controlled. It's also key that you show that that opening of the ring is simultaneous with the attack of the bromide, because again, that's the whole thing that controls the stereochemistry of the reaction. Yes?
What happens if heat's added to that? How does that change the reaction?
Probably would just speed it up. Not yet. We will see reactions next quarter where we can select between products depending on temperature. So any questions whatsoever, any of these mechanism questions? Yes?
And the reason that the cis version is more stable is because?
For which problem, I'm sorry?
The one that you just finished.
The cis is actually probably not likely to be more stable. The trans should be thermodynamically more stable because you would, let me think before I say that. Yes, if you had it trans, you would have the ability to have both substituents equatorial, which that would be lower in energy than having one of the substituents axial. So cis would actually be the less thermodynamically favored product, which it can't even form, though, because the mechanism wouldn't allow it.
The reason I asked is because I circled that, and there was an X over it, so.
Oh. Well, I might have made a mistake then, so if you show it to me afterwards, I'll take a look at it. Any other questions on mechanism? Yes.
Sorry, just anytime you have like a cyclic thing forming,
yes,
in any reaction, when that ring is broken, it's usually conserved.
Yes.
Is that a good?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Let's move to the set of eliminations. Then you had four molecules that you were shown, and you were told that elimination. Well, actually, you weren't told. Yeah, you were. You were told to explain why bimolecular elimination does not occur for these four different molecules. So let's look at the first one. So in this particular case, on one of the carbons neighboring, there aren't any hydrogens there to be able to be eliminated. So you're not going to get elimination in that direction. On the other neighbor, that's a bridgehead carbon that's at the junction of multiple fused rings. And we had discussed Brett's rule violation that says because it is not possible to end up with planar geometry at that position, that's why elimination cannot occur to bridgehead carbons, unless the ring is sufficiently large in size. Questions on the first problem? All right, then for the second one, I think this is the one that most people got correct, because it's the one that we discussed probably the most extensively in class. Exactly the question of whether you can end up with anti-periplanar or sim-periplanar geometry between the hydrogen being eliminated and the bromine. In this case, I've shown the methyl group being trans the bromine, which means implicitly the hydrogen is instead cis to the bromine. So on the top of the ring where the two methyl groups are, you again have a situation where you have no hydrogens. Here, the hydrogen can't be syn or anti-periplanar, which is why no elimination can occur from that position. Questions? Okay, but then the next problem. This was probably the most frequently missed of the problems. Because the one and only reason that elimination cannot occur is there are no hydrogens in the correct position. Many of you said that elimination is not possible from a primary position. But you have to remember, the question specifically stated about bimolecular elimination, which is implying directly that there's some strong base that's reacting. So there's never a carbocation formed in E2 eliminations. And so you don't worry about the fact that the leaving group is at a primary position. So the only thing you do have to worry about is whether there's hydrogens available or not. Now, yes, there's two hydrogens on the same position as the bromine, but those are not the hydrogens that end up being removed in elimination. It is the hydrogen one position away that would be removed. And so that's why elimination is not possible in this compound. Questions?
That was a great problem.
it's a little bit of a tricky problem,
but.
It's
just like, it wasn't that obvious. I think that's great.
Yes?
Explain again? Sure. So let me draw in those two hydrogens. And let me do it where I have a little more room.
So there's a term that's sometimes used position-wise. I mean, we've had these terms vicinal and geminal. Well, this, you could say these are geminal hydrogens. They're on the same carbon. And relative to the bromine, they're ipso. They're on the same position as the bromine. So there is, in fact, another type of reaction that we didn't cover this quarter where it is possible to get rid of a hydrogen and a bromine on the same position to form something called a carbene. But we haven't seen that kind of reactivity. If we're talking about elimination to form a double bond, we have to have a hydrogen that comes from the carbon next door to the position where the bromine is. Because by that hydrogen being removed, a pair of electrons then collapses to kick out that leaving. So yeah, you have hydrogens here, but they wouldn't be the ones that would react in elimination. And then over here, where we do have a position that could eliminate, there aren't any hydrogens. Now, the first part of what I've said is it's not a concern that the fact that bromine's on a primary position. Because primary, secondary, tertiary, they all do E2 elimination. Because there's no carbocation that's involved in E2, only E1. All right, now the last molecule was, again, one that most of you got correct. And that's because of the fact that hydroxide is not a leaving group. It is, in fact, the conjugate base of a weak acid. So conjugates of weak acids are themselves basic, which would make it a terrible leaving group. Yes?
But in this situation, this is where we have to do another reaction to attach a good leader on it, right? If we wanted to interact in a
there are ways to convert that alcohol, yes, but there's no way to directly use it in E2. All right, now let's go to what you were probably most curious about after the exam, the back page problems, the fill-in-the-blank problems. So, first one, starting with a blank, reacting with this nucleophile to form a sulfide. So if you examine that product, we can see that this is a primary substrate. Don't let the deuterium fool you. That's just a form of hydrogen. It's at a primary position, and you were told that all of the reactions in this problem were possible. So backing up, if we look at the nucleophile, that is a strong nucleophile. Because it is charged, it's not neutral, and you have sulfur as the point of the focal point of the nucleophile instead of oxygen. Sulfur nucleophiles are much more nucleophilic than oxygen nucleophiles due to polarizability. And so with a strong nucleophile on a primary position, what kind of reaction had to have happened? SN2. Again, that's because of the strong nucleophile and primary substrate. That means that the reaction had occurred with inversion. So if you're backing up to predict what the starting material had to be, one, we're going to need a leaving group. Because in an SN2, SN1, E1, or E2 reaction, you need a leaving group. Aside from that, you have to invert the stereochemistry at that position because the reaction itself had happened with inversion of stereochemistry. So the most common product that was given was the bromide as the leaving group, and again with the deuterium shown with inversion of configuration. Yes?
I have a question. You said that some things we should have picked up was that the thing that is the substrate is reacting with is charged, it's not neutral. nucleophile?
The nucleophile is charged.
If it's written like that, so you have a salt attached to the SCH3,
right.
To know what is strong and what is not, is there a way you can logically think it out, or do you have to memorize just a part of a chart?
We had discussed in class how if you have equivalent molecules, where you have a sodium or an ion versus a hydrogen there, whenever you have the deprotonated version, that makes it a strong nucleophile. Whenever you have the neutral version, that makes it a weak nucleophile. So on the basis of the fact that it was ionic, that's how you were expected to predict that it was strong.
Okay, I'm sorry. So if it's a salt with SCH3, then it is a strong nucleophile. But
right.
If it's an HSCH3, then
it would
it's
be
not.
Weak. Right.
But if sometimes you see it written above the arrow just with a negative sign attached to it, should you assume anything when you see something like that in terms of trying to figure out the correct?
That would just be the fact that whoever written it had not chosen to show exactly what counter ion was there. But if you still have S minus, that would still make it a strong nucleophile. Oh, thank you. Switch it? Okay. Okay. Other questions about that first problem? All right, next one. Here you had the substrate reacting with something in order to make a secondary alcohol. So this was some form of hydration reaction, of which we had learned, well, technically three this quarter, because we have simple electrophilic addition, we have oxymercuration, demercuration, and we have hydroboration, oxidation. So hydroboration, oxidation is an anti-Markovnikov process. That would put the alcohol at the end of that ethyl group, which is not what we want. So that means it has to be either regular hydration or it has to be oxymercuration, demercuration. It actually cannot be regular simple electrophilic addition because the carbocation that originally formed would be in a secondary position, which would then have a hydride shift to the tertiary position. So this is exactly why we have the oxymercuration-demercuration reaction, because its mechanism does not allow for carbocation migration. So the only correct answer here was first mercury acetate and water, followed by sodium borohydride. You got some partial credit if you showed any of the alcohol-forming reagents, but you only got full credit if you showed this one, and also if you absolutely had to show the one and two, because these reagents do have to be used separately from each other. Yes?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. In your lecture notes, sometimes you put another guy attached to the NADH4, and sometimes you just make it NADH4. Is it optional? Do you have to have sodium
generally, the reason sodium hydroxide is used is because if you have a basic solution, it slows the decomposition of sodium borohydride, which is a topic, in fact, that we'll specifically cover in 12B. So I've been a little bit lazy about it this quarter because it's not something that we have tackled yet. The one key reagent that you must have is the sodium borohydride.
So it'll just, if you do have sodium hydroxide, it'll just allow the BH4 to be intact along with the dual work.
Right. Yes? That's exactly right. Yes?
So we can possibly leave out the sodium hydroxide to the sodium borohydride?
Currently, yes.
So if the carbocation was in the tertiary position, how would undergo simple electrophilization?
Or if, yes, and if you wanted to make the tertiary product, then that would be the appropriate set of reagents to use. Tosic acid and water, yes. So if, in fact, you did use that set of reagents, tosic acid and water. You would end up with the tertiary product. All right, next problem. You're given both the substrate and the reagents, which to abbreviate, that was MCPBA, metachloroperoxybenzoic acid, which that is a reagent used to form epoxides. Since you do have a stereocenter that's formed during epoxidation, you do need to show both of the products, that there are enantiomers formed. Yes?
I'm used to seeing terms of studying for the final, should we get used to seeing what, you know, these things where they use acronyms for, what they actually look like also?
You needed to know what it would look like because potentially I could have asked you for the mechanism of this reaction. It is one of the reactions we've covered. So that was why I showed the reagent instead of abbreviating, expecting that you all would have studied it to be prepared for the mechanism.
So the same would be for DMSO and DMF?
Any of the structures that we've actually seen in lecture with abbreviations, those, yes, you would need to know. Other questions about this problem? All right, let's move on to the next group of three. So we're back to having an absent starting material. Now we do have potassium T-butoxide as a base. We see an alkene as a product, and so we can predict that this is an E2 reaction. Now some of you have been studying from past year's exams or have gotten advice from tutors or some other places because some of you were trying to call each and every one of the reactions either SN1, SN2, E1, E2, because that is a form of question that I had asked in the past. I ignored that, though, because, in fact, most of those reactions were not SN1, SN2, E1, or E2. The first reaction I showed, yes, was actually SN2, but the second two reactions were electrophilic additions, which are not classified as SN1, SN2, E1, E2. So I just want to point that out. Be careful for the final, but only answer what I did ask for, not what I might have asked for 3 years ago. So in this elimination reaction, it means we're going to have some kind of leaving group. And there's a couple of different positions that we might posit it should be. The two most common answers were the ones that I have shown here. Because theoretically, both of them could end up giving the product indicated, except that this is a bulky base. The bulky base ends up favoring the less substituted alkene. So that means that this second product, or second substrate, if I tried to react it under the same conditions, I'm going to get a terminal alkene instead. So the correct answer was, in fact, the first one that I've drawn here. If you put the leaving group at that position, there is only one elimination possible. Now, since the majority of the class did not show stereochemistry, as long as you also did not show stereochemistry, or if you showed correct stereochemistry, I ignored the stereochemistry of this problem. Otherwise, if you showed stereochemistry, you had to make sure that the bromine and the hydrogen were trans to each other, exactly as in the problem that we covered previously in elimination. Yes.
And the conceptual reason why a bulky base would prefer a less substituted alkene, because I'm used to hearing bulky base when you're trying to decide is it elimination or substitution for like SN2.
The reason.
This one, if there's a lot of steric hindrance with bulky bases, does that play a role in the conceptual reason why?
It causes it to be less likely to remove a tertiary versus secondary versus primary hydrogen due to kinetic. So the steric factor. So it's exactly because of the steric hindrance of the base itself that it has an easier time getting to a primary hydrogen versus tertiary. And so that's why you have reverse reactivity, particularly at low temperatures. All right, moving to the next one. So starting out with just an alkane to form an alkyl halide, there is only one reaction we have learned this quarter that can possibly do that, and that's using bromine with light, with UV light. Because HBr, there is no alkene for the hydrogen to be attacked by. Br2 without light, again, there's no double bond to be able to react. The only thing that can force a plain alkane to react is some form of radical species. So the only correct answer would have been, again, bromine and light. And since there were no hydrogens other than the hydrogens on the methyl groups, there was only one monohalogenated product possible. Yes?
What did you say for the first two other scenarios that would work for this? It can't be HBr.
It can't be HBr, and it can't be bromine without light.
And it can't be HBr because...
there's no alkene to react. Because HBr is ionic, mm-hmm. and this is only reactable if you have something radical.
And it won't go through a radical reaction if you don't have HB.
Right.
Which is not heat, mm-hmm. but it's just a form of light.
Right. All right. Next reaction. Cis-alkene reacting with D2 and platinum. So, I don't think anybody got thrown off by the fact that we had deuterium here instead of hydrogen. The only thing that did happen is whether or not you showed correct stereochemistry. So remember that this is a syn addition because the alkene adds from one face down onto the metal, the platinum catalyst, where the deuterium's already been adsorbed. So the two deuteria, if you write it with the structure in this orientation, are either both going to be wedges, so they're both pointed towards you, or both going to be dashes, both pointed away from you. Now, the one mistake that happened besides stereochemistry is if you show dashes and wedges, you got to remember to put hydrogens in if they're really supposed to be hydrogens there. Because if you just write a wedge or a dash and you don't show anything else, that's a methyl group. So the correct answers were these. Which again, if you wanted to show the hydrogens by showing the others, dashes, and wedges, you had to write the hydrogens in. Questions about that problem? Yes?
The value above the arrow is either hydrogen or deuterium, or I'm not sure what it's related to, but it's usually hydrogen stuff, right? For this particular reaction, it's usually some sort of diatomic hydrogen version.
Well, because it's a hydrogenation reaction, yes.
But we should expect below the arrow possibly palladium, and then there was one more.
Platinum.
Platinum, okay.
Or with an alkyne, we had Lindler's catalyst to specifically make a cis alkene versus a trans. Right. Last three reactions. Something reacting with borane THF complex, followed by hydrogen peroxide and water, or not water, sodium hydroxide, to make a secondary alcohol. So you need an alkene, because that's what borane reacts with. And so I'll throw two of the most common answers up. One of which, in which the alkene is terminal, and one in which it's internal connected to the ring. It is, in fact, that second structure that's correct, because hydroboration is going to put the alcohol at the less substituted position. If we had used the first of the two starting materials I've shown, you'd end up with the alcohol at the end of the molecule, which is not what we want. So I had to use the internal alkene in order to be able to get the borane, or the alcohol, to the less substituted position. Because if we had done hydroboration oxidation, we'd end up with the alcohol in the wrong place. All right, two more. So we have an allyl system, an allyl bromide that reacts with something to form an allyl ether. Since we have a tertiary substrate where we don't form an alkene, that means it's SN1. Because no SN2 is possible in a tertiary substrate. Since it's SN1, that means the reaction could only happen with a weak nucleophile. And so to give the right number of carbons, that means the only nucleophile possible was ethanol. You could not use any form of charged nucleophile because that would have been basic and would have caused elimination instead. Last reaction, and then we're going to be out of time, is some kind of alkene reacting with bromine and water. That is for the formation of a halohydrin, which many of you got, but somehow with the structure that I drew, a common mistake was counting the number of carbons incorrectly. So what you're going to end up with is bromine on the less substituted position because it was originally the electrophile, and the alcohol on the more substituted position. And in this case, you didn't need to show stereochemistry because there's no stereocenters. Yes?
Is there a reason that epoxide isn't formed?
Because there's no sodium hydride or any other base to cause the closure of the ring after the formation of the halohydrin. Epoxides form if you deprotonate the oxygen here, and then that oxygen does an intramolecular SN2 attack, which is something I showed in lecture. But we don't have the sodium hydride to cause that supplementary reaction. So if you just have bromine and water, it's a halohydrin that forms. All right, so we're out of time. I'll be heading to office hours from here, so if you did have questions about your exam, you can follow me there. We will start out with the lab exam first when we come back to lab. And actually, I'm realizing that might be why we have a few